Hey there, Pastor Ben here. Continuing with our study through the Minor Prophets, today we're taking our first glimpse into the Book of Joel. The Book of Joel is on the shorter side for the Minor Prophets, consisting of only three chapters, and not a lot is known about Joel himself, as we'll see in the beginning of this chapter. We get just a short phrase about who he is and who his father was, but other than that, we don't really know anything except that the Lord spoke to him and he delivered a message to God's people and to us today. Joel is also uncertain for scholars where it lands in the timeline. Some place Joel as one of the earliest minor prophets, others place them later. But regardless of exactly when the book was written, we know why the book was written, and we know what message God was sending to his people. So as we look through this book, we'll find that a lot of it is poetic in nature, as is often the case with prophecy. And so we'll do our best not to get bogged down in imagery, but really look at the reality of what's happening. And we'll see some of those same themes that we saw in Hosea as far as sin and the destructive implications of it, but then also the love and the call to repentance that God has for all to turn away from their sin and to turn to him. So let us read. Joel 1, the word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. Again, this is all the demographic information we get to know. But it is nice to know that in this case, the word of the Lord is coming to Joel. Some of the prophets have visions or experience different things, sign acts. This is just very simply the Lord giving the word to Joel and Joel giving God's word then to his people. And he says this in verse 2. Hear this, you elders. Give ear, all inhabitants of the land. Has such a thing happened in your days or in the days of your fathers? Tell it, tell your children of it, and let your children tell their grandchildren and their children to another generation. So what he's setting up is there is something that's happening that is so extreme that no one will forget it, and it will be continued, the story of it will be continued to pass from generation to generation. And so what is this thing that's happening? In verse 4, what the cutting locust left, the swarming locust has eaten. What the swarming locust left, the hopping locust has eaten. And what the hopping locust left, the destroying locust has eaten. And so this is a picture of just a devastating destruction of the crops by locusts. The Hebrew words in here are not clear. They're not words that are used outside of the Old Testament. But what we're seeing is if there's four layers of locusts that are destroying the crops, essentially there is an utter and complete destruction of everything by this. But what we'll see is it's not just nature. It's not just, oh, this bad thing has happened. But we'll see that this is from God, that God is in control of nature and in control of all things. And he is using this to send a message. So here is the message in verse 5. Awake, you drunkards, and weep, and wail, all you drinkers of wine, because of the sweet wine, for it is cut off from your mouth. Again, there is no crops, there is no vegetation, and so even wine is cut off from availability. For a nation has come up against my land, powerful and beyond number. Its teeth are lion's teeth, and it has the fangs of a lioness. It has laid waste my vine and splintered my fig tree. It has stripped off their bark and thrown it down. Their branches are made white. So anything that even had the chance to potentially grow in the future is being destroyed in a way in such that it cannot grow any longer. This is complete, again, an utter just devastation of the land. And so the call in verse 8 is, how do we react to it? In verse 5, he said, awake, you drunkards. In verse 8, he says, lament like a virgin wearing sackcloth for the bridegroom of her youth. Now, this picture is really interesting. It's a short phrase, but a virgin wearing sackcloth for her bridegroom means that she was betrothed to marry someone, and that someone died before she even got to have marital relations, right? That's why she's a virgin. And so that extreme grief and mourning is how God is telling and through Joel the people that they should be reacting. This is how bad things are. We also see in verse 9, the grain offering and the drink offering are cut off from the house of the Lord. The priests mourn, the ministers of the Lord. Again, these offerings that are cut off, there's two sides to it. There's the very human physical side that these are the offerings that the priests would have been consuming. So the idea that the priests are losing out on their sustainability is part of this. And then, of course, there's the religious side of this too, that if there's no offerings to God, right, we are missing out on how we're in that time supposed to relate to God. And so this is just a really, really not good place to be in. And again, we see just further description in verse 10. The fields are destroyed, the ground mourns, right? The actual physical ground, the idea that it's mourning, right? Again, this is poetry, but what a thought that, even nature itself is not happy with how things have turned out. Because the grain is destroyed, the wine dries up, the oil languishes, right? Again, just nothing. Nothing is there. And then there's this third response. So we saw, awake, you drunkards, lament like a virgin, and now be ashamed, verse 11, O tillers of the soil, wail, O vine dressers, for the wheat and the barley, because the harvest of the field has perished. The vine dries up, the fig tree languishes. Pomegranate, palm, and apple, all the trees of the field are dried up, and gladness dries up from the children of man. So we start to see the turn here of what's happening physically in the land is representative also of emotionally what's going on inside of the hearts of the people, right? Gladness dries up, just like the fruits of the vines and the trees have dried up and are no longer producing. And so now we see it starting in verse 13, a call to respond then to God, not just to respond to the tragedy that's happening, but now we need to cry out. And so in verse 13, it says, put on sackcloth and lament, O priests, wail, O ministers of the altar. Go in, pass the night in sackcloth, O ministers of my God, because grain offering and drink offering are withheld from the house of your God. Consecrate a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the elders and all the inhabitants of your land to the house of the Lord your God, and cry out to the Lord. Again, it's not a passive, oh, woe is me, these bad things are happening, but God is inviting, call out to me. The things that are happening are not a surprise, but also they're not out of my purview to help make better either. But why are these happening? Why are these things happening? If we keep reading, verse 15, alas for the day of the Lord is near, and as destruction from the Almighty it comes. The day of the Lord is going to come up several times in Joel as a main theme. This idea again of God's wrath being poured out of this ultimate destruction that comes about because of the consequences of sin. And so, we see the contrast of the day of the Lord versus what it's like to be with God in verse 16. Is not the food cut off before our eyes? Joy and gladness from the house of our God, right? If things are right, if our relationship is right with God, we see that joy and gladness are available, but the people here are cut off from that. And then we see an interesting image. Verse 17, the seed shrivels under the clods. The storehouses are desolate. The granaries are torn down because the grain has dried up. This picture here of the seed shriveling under the clods, the idea that the drought is not just a famine, but there's drought as well, and the ground is so dry that any seeds that they've planted, the ground has dried up, and so the seeds are exposed because there's not enough wet earth for them to even stay buried underneath the soil. And then moving into verse 18, not just about vegetation, right? But 18, how the beasts groan. The herds of cattle are perplexed because there is no pasture for them. Even the flocks of sheep suffer. So, again, pulling in just important pieces of the agrarian culture there, and knowing that the animals are also recognizing this is not good. And then we see this from Joel in verse 19. To you, O Lord, I call. He's the only one that we can call out to in this situation. For fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness, and flame has burned all the trees of the field. Even the beasts of the field pant for you, because the water brooks are dried up, and fire has devoured the pastures of the wilderness. So not only are the domestic crops gone, not only are just the general places for the animals to eat and drink gone, but it's not just from the locusts as we saw described in the beginning, but there has been a fire that has just totally wiped out. So if there was any question by the time we get to the end of chapter one about what is available to the people, the answer is nothing. And this is why we cry out to God. And so in verse two, we see then what the instructions are for the people and how to go about dealing with this situation. And so in chapter 2, verse 1, it says, blow a trumpet in Zion, sound an alarm on my holy mountain. Right, the shofar of the trumpet would be used for both military reasons and religious reasons. And so this call to people is a call to action. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. It is near. And here's how Joel describes the day of the Lord. Verse 2 says, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness. Like blackness, there is spread upon the mountains a great and powerful people. Their like has never been before, nor will ever be again after them, throughout all the years of all generations. And we see again this image of fire. In verse 3, fire devours before them, and behind them a flame burns. The land is like the Garden of Eden before them, but behind them a desolate wilderness. Nothing escapes them. This people is further described the day of the Lord as this army in verses 4 and 5. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, and like war horses they run. As with the rumbling of chariots, they leap on the tops of mountains, like the crackling of a flame of fire devouring the stubble, like a powerful army drawn up for battle. Before them, peoples are in anguish, all faces grow pale. Like warriors, they charge, like soldiers, they scale the wall. They march each on his way. They do not swerve from their paths. They do not jostle one another. Each marches in his path. They burst through the weapons and are not halted. Again, a poetic way of showing just this, the precision of this military force, the idea that everyone is so perfectly marching in line and doing the things they're supposed to do. There's not hustle and bustle like you might expect in some kind of army fight, right? But this action is so perfect and so precise that in my mind, I imagine, it's almost this computer-generated thing, right? This perfect scenario versus sort of the chaos that we usually would think of in an army. But that's how potent the destruction of the day of the Lord is. Verse 9, they leap upon city wall, they leap upon the city, they run upon the walls, they climb up into houses, they enter through the windows like a thief. The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble. The sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. The Lord utters his voice before his army, for his camp is exceedingly great. He who executes his word is powerful. So again, if we had any question about what's happening, right here is the proof. God is behind all of these things. And why? Because the weight of our sin is so great, and the offense to God's holiness is insurmountable without Jesus. And so finally we see at the end of verse 11, for the day of the Lord is great and very awesome. Who can endure it? It is a rhetorical question that clearly the answer, if we've read up to this point and saw all of the things happening, none can endure it. And so, though, in the middle of all this darkness, we see in verse 12 the first really clear light that we've seen in this book so far. Yet, even now, even in the middle of all of this awfulness, declares the Lord, Return to me with all your heart, with fasting, with weeping, and with mourning. So again, there's an action side to this and an emotional side to this, with fasting and then weeping and mourning, right? These are responses that show the truth of how we feel, not just performing actions without meaning. Because as we see in the next, at the beginning of verse 13, and rend your hearts and not your garments, right? This idea of, if I'm in so much anguish, I tear my clothes, right? This is this ancient way of showing just how extreme an emotion is. But what God cares about is our hearts, rending our hearts, right? The idea of we are so offended by our own sin that we break our own hearts so that we can turn back to God. And again, we see return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster. Right? These things that have been happening are not things that bring God joy, but they are necessary things in order to bring God's people back to him. And then we see another kind of rhetorical question that we'll see in other prophets as well, this idea that we see in verse 14. Who knows whether he will not turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him, a grain offering and a drink offering for the Lord your God? Again, this is not outside of the thought of the hope of appealing to God's character, but it's also realizing we don't have control over the way that God is going to respond. It's our job to respond in the way God tells us to. What God does with that is still up to him. And then verse 15, as we saw echoed in verse 1 of this chapter, blow the trumpet in Zion, consecrate a fast, call a solemn assembly, gather the people, right? Fasting, praying, bringing the people together under the religious leaders in order to get right, get back into the right relationship with God. Consecrate the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children, even nursing infants. Let the bridegroom leave his chamber and the bride her chamber. So there's nothing that's more important than getting back into the right relationship with God. There's something that's gone on that cannot be fixed in our own power. And then finally, in verse 17, between the vestibule and the altar, let the priests, the ministers of the Lord, weep and say, spare your people, O Lord, and make not your heritage a reproach, a byword among the nations. Why should they say among the peoples, where is their God? So again, this call to God's people and identifying ourselves with God, and also recognizing when God has called us, we still bear that identity. And so being able to, for ourselves, call that on and remind ourselves, okay, I am a child of God. So when I put that moniker on, what does that mean? And that's what Joel is asking these people to consider. As we look at the rest of the book of Joel next week, we'll see just the beauty of what it looks like when we do repent and when God does show his everlasting kindness, his steadfast love, his grace, and his mercy. And so even when we're sitting in these deep, dark, hard places, just knowing that it is not that God is doing those things because he is vengeful and wanting to hurt us, but he knows that our sin has consequences and that circumstances that are difficult are sometimes useful in bringing us back into a right relationship with him.